This is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. My guest has one of the most unique and impressive resumes. He's a member of the College Football Hall of Fame after his brilliant career at Penn State. First-round draft pick of the Cincinnati Bengals and two-time All-Pro defensive lineman. But we're just getting started. Mike Reed is a Grammy Award winner, inducted in 2005 to the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame. He's penned 12 number one hits and had his own number one hit song, Walk on Faith.
If we walk on faith, trust in love, just keep on putting one foot down in front of the other. When the valley's so wide, we stumble and stride, everything inside wants to give up. Walk on.
During the 1970 Orange Bowl on NBC, Jim Simpson and Al DeRogatis gave us a preview of what we could expect from this multi-talented individual.
McMillan hit back across the 15-yard line, and look who's got it. The Outland Trophy winner, Mike Reed.
Mike Reed has the instinct of a great pass rusher, and he tries to avoid any kind of contact, uses his hands, loops around them.
I think many people know this, Al, but Reed is a concert pianist and composer, and they tell me he can play a 33-page Tchaikovsky piano concerto by heart.
In 1997, Mike Reed wrote the music for The Ballad of Little Joe. That musical is now running from June 3rd through June 26th at Two River Theater in Red Bank. Let's head to the theater's library and meet singer-songwriter and football legend, Mike Reed. The amazing Mike Reed, Penn Stater. We are Penn State. So glad to see you, and what an honor it is to have you on the show.
Well, you're extremely, your introduction is... You know, there are a couple of ways to look at that introduction. You could say, well, that's pretty interesting. But the other way is, gee, that guy's lived a life in fear of a real job. You know, I've managed to stay one step ahead of a real job. Maybe the point of that is for anybody to try to find what they love in the world and love in life and pursue that if at all possible. But it's funny that you enumerate those things. My life doesn't feel that way. I suppose it's because I'm always kind of more interested in what's up the road ahead rather than what's behind. So,
and maybe that's why everything you do has led to success, Mike, because from the time you were in Altoona playing football and wrestling to moving to Nashville in 1980, and by 1984 you win a Grammy Award for writing songs. So everywhere you've gone. And you've done several musicals now. We're excited to know more about The Ballad of Little Joe. You know, I could only see the trailer of the 1993 movie. I didn't get a chance to see the actual movie. But give us the little bit of the synopsis of the story of The Ballad of Little Joe.
It's based on, first of all, it's a true story. A woman is named Josephine Monahan, was named Josephine Monahan, born to money and standing in Boston in... 1860-70s or in there, and was a little bit of the black sheep of the family, had a child out of wedlock, humiliated her father, who said, we're going to raise the baby, and she said, I have to get out of here. She left the father's home to go west. The gold rush was, and mining, was on at the time, silver, to make a stake, make some money, and then come back, get her baby, and make a life for herself. And in the process, I'm giving you the short overview, going out there, she got thrown off a train around Idaho and attacked and brutalized by a couple of soldiers. It was post-Civil War, and so the soldiers were wandering, mountains and areas and whatnot. Brutalized by a couple of soldiers, and to hide from their further in their finding her, she disguised herself as a man, for protection. And the curious thing, and no one knows why this is, she then proceeded to live the rest of her life that way. And now it's not a gender issue. This was a woman who disguised herself as a man. And perhaps the consideration would be, she disguised herself to be what was necessary to be to get what you wanted, to survive in a very, very difficult time and a very challenging area, you know, brutal area time and time. And so she lived the rest of her life that way. So that's essentially what then they didn't know that Joe, little Joe, they called him little, he's an odd little man, this little Joe, was actually Josephine until she died and they did an autopsy and found a few things missing. So, and that became a story, you know. And in the, it's interesting, in the census of the time, it's where you had to list the sex, you know, male or female on the census, hers was listed as undetermined. Yeah, it's a really fascinating thing. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of areas, a lot of area to wander in there and try to figure out why would a person do that? And that's what we, whether we succeeded or not, there are models that you put over the story, all human being, that are applicable to all. This is one person's life, but the model, whether it's James Joyce's monomyth or Joseph Campbell, the hero's journey, which is available to every human being, which is the journey to the deepest experience of your own life you can have. And in her case, you can't do that when you're pretending to be someone else. And eventually she comes, learns that through a character in the piece and becomes, eventually reclaims herself, in our piece anyway. There's a lot of wide open room to tell a story, and we've used that area to imagine what the reasons might have been.
Now, you adapted this from the movie that I mentioned, Susie Amos playing Little Joe. Those, of course, know composer James Cameron. That's James Cameron's wife. She is now an activist, no longer in the acting profession. But was it, when did you decide that the research into Little Joe to say, yeah, I want to get involved in this?
You know what? I got to be completely honest with you here. I hope I'm honest in everything I say. I'm not sure I would have chosen this. I had written a show with a fellow named Mac Perkle at Tennessee Repertory Theater in Nashville, based on the small family during the Civil War. And I learned from that experience writing a musical about the Civil War that the Civil War usually wins. We got it up, but it was not successful. I wouldn't have necessarily chosen this, but with the opportunity, it was chosen as part of a Hal Prince workshop. And so the opportunity, I was in New York working on a little one-act opera with my partner, Sarah Schlesinger, and this opportunity came up that we would be in the Hal Prince workshop. And I imagine we probably thought at the time, maybe we'll get to rub elbows with Hal and he can become aware of our work. Whether or not I would have chosen this specifically, because it's not the traditional lightweight, there's humor in this piece. There's a lot of air in this piece, and there's a lot of humor, and I don't believe in badgering an audience for 2 hours in the theater. Nobody wants that. But it was an opportunity to work with Hal, and then we had to find our way through it. Say, okay, we wrote one of the most difficult things we encountered was one of the very best songs that remains in the show today, was the first song we wrote. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, that song is really, I never think this about my own things, but I thought if we can write a show that earns that moment, we might be onto something. So off we went, and it's been a long, interesting, circuitous route to get to where we are.
I know the people here at Two River Theater have been talking for a long time about The Ballad of Little Joe coming to the theater and have been very exciting. John D is here, directorial debut. Mm-hmm. So, you know, obviously he feels something about this piece.
He's also a book writer. He came on as a book writer some years ago. And the musical theater, I think theater in general, but certainly musical theater, I've worked in opera, in the world of opera and chamber music, country songs, pop songs. There's nothing more difficult. I can't think of anything that comes close to the difficulty of getting a musical right. And it's the most collaborative form I've ever experienced. You cannot do this on your own. Very few people. Music man, Meredith Wilson, he wrote the music book and the lyrics to that show. But that's pretty rare. It's an extremely collaborative art form. When John Diaz came into the project and became a book writer, the piece would not be what it is without John Diaz and his insight. So I at first was not 100% sure about a book writer directing, but this piece is so in John's body. And he revealed to us in a very touching moment when we were getting ready to start rehearsals, that he said Josephine Monaghan, he made a promise to her years ago that he would never forget her. And I was so touched by that. It was such a beautiful thing to say that at this point, and now we're weeks of rehearsal in, and there's no reason John shouldn't direct. He's finding the heart and center of the piece, and there's a young man named Mark Kimmelman who's putting, he's a choreographer, putting action and body movement into the piece that's adding a dimension it's never had before. So, you know, I get to stand on the sidelines and hand the music over to a music director and see if it works or not.
I know you'd mentioned that it was a survival mode for her to change, you know, and basically portray herself as a man. But do you think maybe after spending time as a man, she could have possibly felt that that was who she really should be?
That's not addressed in the piece. That's a very, very fair question. These are the things we don't know. You know, she didn't write anything to let anyone know exactly why she did what she did. But she lived for decades as a man, so she must have, you know, there had to be a time where she thought, yeah, this is how. I would also imagine in the town of Silver City where it takes place that she got in rather, I would guess, rather quickly in over her head and to announce to these, and keep in mind, this was a tough, brutal tents and cabins, shanty mining town. These were not your, you know, new age people, you know, with lots of gentler insights. These were hard Scrabble times. So perhaps she got in over her head and thought, well, I can't reveal who I am now at this point. But it is a curious thing. She had a relationship with a young Chinese man out there who was there to, had originally been there to assist in building the railroads, and that eventually she had a relationship with him. Now how deep it went, again, there's nothing written about it, so she never revealed to anyone, but she certainly had interaction with that man that no one else knew about.
We're going to talk a lot more about your writing and singing career, but I wanted to touch upon right now is the fact that someone who could be so ferocious on a football field, boy, there's a real sensitive side to Mike Reed. When you listen to your lyrics, you listen to you sing, the passion. When I hear you talk about Little Joe, it's not what we think about when we think about that guy who would go after the quarterback. I heard the late Merlin Olsen talk about, it's a job. It's a job. I was supposed to do that. When I'm off the field, I was me. Yeah. Is that Mike Reed?
Well, I'll tell you, the difference between Merlin and I knew Merlin was Merlin Olsen, one of the loveliest human beings I had ever met. Now, Merlin's physical gifts were amazing. He was a big, powerful, strong guy, and he was right there in his element. I was a small defensive tackle in the pros. I was average size for college, you know. This was before unfortunately, the steroid thing, and everyone blew up, and you had to be 300 pounds. I was a good size for college, probably 235, 240 for a defensive lineman. But I had, because in the pros, because I was a little slightly undersized, and speed was my game in the pros, I really had to psychologically, mentally amp myself up, you know, and try to get to survive, because I was always, week in and week out, up against guys good, substantially bigger than me. So I had to get up to a place where, I was going to have to figure out a way to get as much physically out of myself as I possibly could. I don't think anybody, you know, there you can look back at some old films of Dick Butkus, of Ray Nitschke, Willie Lanier, particularly the great middle linebackers, who just hit guys, and you think, man, you can't imagine how that guy's going to get up. I might be naive. I don't think those guys ever intended to hurt anybody. I think they intended to play the game. Look, there are no rules. There are certain rules. You can't punch people. You can't. But there's no rule against how hard you can hit someone. I think guys like that wanted to play. And I know with me, I wanted to play the game on as high and intense a level as I possibly could. And it probably if you were in the stands, it might have appeared to be pretty fierce. But I think it's guys on the field just taking advantage that this is a physical, aggressive game. And I'm gonna play this as all out. You have to go all out. I mean, when you don't go all out, you're really risking injury. You're really risking going halfway.
Tackle Mike Reed, number 74, was credited with 3 individual sacks as the Bengals won their 3rd game of the year. The following week, Cincinnati continued its assault on rival quarterbacks. Against the Chiefs, the Bengals compiled 6 more sacks, and Mike Reed got 5 of them.
Mike Reed goes all out in his music, and his music is the Ballad of Little Joe, the musical that's here at Two River Theater, running from June 3rd to the 26th. One of the outstanding musicals that has played here in the past is Be More Chill, and one of the actors who was one of the stars is in this show. Let's talk about the cast of your wonderful musical.
I don't think this piece was done in London at the Bridewell. It was a beautiful cast of English and Scottish actors. A small production, very passionate. Actors tend to just, when they discover this story, they tend to hurl themselves. I mean, you've never seen anything like a group of actors who are committed to a piece. They really might be my single favorite group of people. Individually, they're interesting to deal with, but as a group, to see a group of actors commit to a piece is incredible. I really do believe, as much as I appreciate every time this piece has been done, it was done in Chicago at the Steppenwolf Theater some years ago. I don't believe it'll ever be sung. It's never been sung as well as it's going to be sung here. Jane Bruce, Eric Morris, and Teal Wicks, the three major, are just major principal characters. All sing and act on a level that is, I think, as an ensemble, is very rare. I think it's very rare for me. They have just climbed inside this music, and it's a strange thing. The level of their musicianship is extraordinary. It's not just about singing notes, singing the words, remembering the words, and singing the notes. They all have a level of musicianship, of how to phrase. How to backphrase. Backphrasing, we don't want to be too technical. Backphrasing would be, here's the ultimate backphraser, would be Willie Nelson, when he sings a little behind the beat, a little lag. When the front of the beat is where all the urgency is. So when you want to create urgency, you sing the front of the beat. When you want to find the emotion, you sing in the back half of the beat. You can't always teach that. And all three of these people do this instinctively. So there's enormous emotion in what they're doing. But the touching thing, their intonation, which is, can you sing in tune? Their intonation is immaculate. I wonder if they even know how to sing out of tune. And they've just connected with these characters. So I'm getting to hear this music in a way I never have before on a level which is not to say I don't deeply appreciate what has come before. But whatever the life of this piece is, I will leave Red Bank knowing that I've heard it as I... Well, not only as I heard it in my head, but maybe even beyond what I heard in my head.
You know, I spoke to a good friend of mine who used to be a public radio news director and now is a writer in the country music field, Dan Modlin, who has met you. He was pretty sure you wouldn't remember him, but he's met you at the Bluebird Cafe, I believe.
Sure.
And I asked him, I said, you know, I'm going to be interviewing Mike, and what would you want to know as a fellow songwriter for Mike Reed? And he said, when you're writing with Alan Chamblin and the wonderful songs that you've written with him, working together to combine melody and lyrics and doing it so well, what's the key to that?
The key is, indefinable? Something you can't define. And it's the collaborative effort. Look, Richard Rodgers, not to equate any of us with the great Richard Rodgers. Rodgers wrote with a number of people, particularly after Hammerstein, you know. But he connected in an indefinable way with two people, Lorenz Hart and Oscar Hammerstein. If you look at the experience of collaboration, you look at some of the great collaborations in the world of the Beatles, Lennon, McCartney. There was very often what happens, and as I say, I want to underscore that I'm not putting any of us in the category of the people I've mentioned. But if you're looking for that ingredient, very often what happens, I've collaborated with people, written songs with people that I don't necessarily connect with. And you can hear it in the song. The song might be perfectly constructed. It might be well constructed. It might be a decent idea. Missing something. What is it? I don't know what that is. I know with Alan Chamblin, great Nashville songwriter from Texas, I think with Alan and I, we've always felt, and not to get too mystical about this, that there is a third personality that exists in the room when he and I get together. And we submit to that third personality. And that third personality that exists between Alan and I is a brutal, he will not, or she, it could be she, I don't know, will not let us finish something that is not absolutely as it should be. I know personally myself as a writer of anything, I've never made a determination that anything I did was any good. What I do is if I look at something and I think, okay, I would not change anything. That's come as close as I can come to my intent. And I would say that to any writer that happens to be listening to this. That is the one thing the single thing you have the capacity to control in your work. What do you intend? Have you thought long and hard enough about it to know what you mean and what you're intending, and can you get close to that? I find that if you get close to that, then regardless of what anyone else thinks about it, they might like it, they might hate it, they might not get it, you can withstand that. But it has to be, you're really vulnerable when you go into the public with work that you didn't intend or you're not sure is what you mean. Then you really lay yourself open. So Alan and I, and any of, there's another fellow, Rory Burke and I, collaboration. There's a young, I'm going to mention this young woman. Her name is Rachel Womack. She's 22 years old from Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and she sought me out. She's an artist. She's a singer. I mean, and this kid is world class. She sought me out because she had connected with a song on an album I made. And getting in the room with this kid, she's 22 years old, and she's an argument for the age of the soul, young, teenage, or old souls. This kid's an old soul. And I don't know what it is. You just know when you're in the presence of it that there is another thing. You're connecting in a way that you don't necessarily connect with other people. If you could manufacture that, if you could know what that was, you'd do it every time. But it just has to happen on its own.
You're listening to Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. My guest is Mike Reed, who has written the music for The Ballad of Little Joe, a musical that's running from June 3rd through June 26th at Two River Theater in Red Bank. Mike Reed, a member of the College Football Hall of Fame for his brilliant days at Penn State, first-round draft pick of the Cincinnati Bengals, Grammy Award-winning songwriter, and he wrote this song for Bonnie Raitt that became a smash hit.
Turn down the lights, turn down the bed, turn down these voices inside my head. Lay down with me. tell me no lies. Just hold me close, don't patronize, don't patronize me. 'Cause I can't
I thought when I saw Rodney Foster last year in New Jersey talking about all the songs he's written for Keith Urban and Sarah Evans and how his kitchen is basically thanks to Keith Urban. when Bonnie Raitt, I Can't Make You Love Me, was such a beautiful song that was your song that, you know, she just turned into a smash hit. Stranger in My House with Ronnie Millsap and other collaborations with Ronnie. Is there a sense of you that when you hear them make this success, of course you get the money as the writer, and it is your song, but a lot of times they get the credit for it. How do you feel as a writer about that?
Oh, I have absolutely zero problem with that. Not one bit. I think you have to understand what it takes to be an artist. Ronnie Millsap, for years, he and his wife Joyce, before he had a record deal, she was loading and unloading his gear out of a station wagon, going into any club that would let him play. Until when he came to Nashville, he set up in a joint outside of Nashville. The record labels discovered him, began having hits. You think you're having hits? You're on your way. Oh no, the trouble just starts then. You know, and then you load up a U-Haul with seven guys in a station wagon. Then you manage to find the material you keep having growing as an artist. And now you have a bus. And now you have a bigger band. And now let's take some sets. Okay, and some sets. Well, all this begins to cost money, you know. And you better, an artist's life, and particularly, it's even truer now than it was back in the 80s. You've got to be a road dog. You got to get out there and you got to do it. And those are people, Bonnie, Ronnie, are people that night after night when they're on tour, they sleep in hotels, they sleep on their buses, they get up, they sign autographs, they do everything that most writers are not willing to do. I get my props, you know, I get my it's not, we won't get too much into this, but it's a death of a songwriter to begin to think that you either know what you're doing or that you're the deal. It's really, you're really, you know, then you know what happens then? When that happens, then the gratitude that you feel for being in the business, that anyone is singing anything of yours, begins to morph into expectation. And when that happens and you start expecting, yeah, you're on a big old banana peel. And it's just a matter of time before you're sitting on your backside. So I have no problem. I get plenty of, plenty from plenty of people that know, that read the labels and all that. But those artists, the great artists that take the material to the world, deserve every amount of credit they get.
There's a silence here between us I've never heard before. Understand when I'm holding her.
And you and Ronnie sang on Old Folks. It went went to number two on the charts. You also had a number one hit yourself, Walk on Faith. So you've had that opportunity of feeling as an artist as well. Just today, I looked on YouTube. 25 million hits for Adele singing your song. How does that make you feel?
Well, look, just to be able to say that Adele sings one of your songs, because I adore that woman. I don't expect in my lifetime to ever meet her, but there is something. Look, you talk about artists, you know, that's an art. Nobody, look, I'm sure some years ago someone said, here's this slightly, you know, just full-figured, nice-looking woman, you know. I got to believe that a lot of people said no to her labels. And that were listed, often sometimes the business. One of the troubles with the business is they sometimes look for, they try to find what something isn't rather than what it is, and can miss what something is. And I bet a lot of people miss that kid. You know, well, she's a kid to me. To be able to say, yeah, by the way, Adele has, out of that musical entity that we know of as Adele, came something I wrote.
It's one of my favourite songs. I think it's just perfect in every single way. And she's got a stunning voice. And yeah, the lyrics, they're just pretty mind-blowing, really. Okay, so I'm going to do a couple of covers in a row now. This is Bonnie Raitt, I Can't Make You Love Me.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary feeling. It was also, that song's had it, you know, Prince did a version of that song, and George Michael, there's just something. And at that point, when that starts happening, I think I speak for Alan on this, we really don't feel as though it's our song. It came through us. We happened to be paying attention at the time to the idea. We wrote it incorrectly for 6 months. It was this up-tempo bluegrass song for 6 months until I found this other music. And I thought, this idea might work with this other music. And then we finished the song. No, you can't plan for things like that. And it becomes overwhelming to where you just, I think you'd be a fool to feel as though it's all because of you. Very mysterious thing why certain songs happen in the way they do and others don't. Gratitude, 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 that's the order of the day.
Maybe not when you originally wrote it, but when you heard Bruce Hornsby playing with Bonnie singing, you knew you had magic, right?
I knew it was me. You know, when I first heard when they sent me a recording, I thought I was expecting strings and guitars and background vocals. And Don Was, who produced the record, said they actually had that on the record. And they got it all mixed. And Don said, man, I listened to it and I thought, what happened? We've lost something here. And I said, yeah, well, what'd you do, Don? He said, well, we just started pulling faders down. The faders, for those of you who don't know, they're little things in this recording studio that determine the level of an instrument. When you just pull those down, slide those down, you lose that sound. So we just started pulling faders down until we had piano, Bruce on piano, bass, a little bit of drums, and Bonnie, and pretty much a little sweetening, but that was about it. And at that point, then she began to emerge, and the song began to emerge. And he said he'd learned, he told me, he said, I realized something. He said that when you're producing an artist like Bonnie, there's a difference between producing a great record and producing a great artist. Bonnie's a great artist. And what the producer, Don was perfect for her because he would ask himself, everything I do to this record, is it going to get in the way of her relationship with the listener, or is it going to enhance and give the listener an intimate relationship with her? That's a great producer's point of view.
You're listening to Sports Jam. My guest is singer-songwriter Mike Reed, who is also a member of the College Football Hall of Fame and two-time All-Pro defensive lineman with the Cincinnati Bengals. The Grammy Award winner also is a member of the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame one of his huge hits being performed right now by jazz vibraphonist Joe Locke, I Can't Make You Love Me. Amazing perspective from Mike Reed, who has written the music, and The Ballad of Little Joe is running from June 3rd to June 26th here at Two River Theater in Red Bank. You know, powerful women are getting more and more opportunities in all kinds of ways, and their stories are being told. But this is a different take because she wanted to, you know, she had to survive and be a man, Little Joe. So also with musicals, our theater critic Michael Bourne says, you want to be humming a song as you leave the theater. What song are we leaving humming?
Oh, what a great question. What a wonderful question. That's a tough one. I am by nature, I must tell you, and it goes counter to a little bit of contemporary music. Historically, there at different times, contemporary popular music will be driven by different things. By that, I mean, if you look at, let's go to Showboat, 1929, the father of the popular song, Jerome Kern. Up through the 30s, you had the Gershwins, Richard Rodgers in the 40s with Oklahoma. You couldn't be a songwriter then if you couldn't write a melody. You had to, songwriting was predominantly great lyrics and great melodies. Rock and roll came along. And made it about a primal sort of tribal anarchy. Turn it up loud as you can go, play these three chords, and sing these, you know, Rock Around the Clock. And Dylan comes, you know, and became, out of Dylan and Paul Simon in the 60s, became James Taylor and Joni Mitchell, a level of literacy in the lyrics, you know. We're in a period now in popular music where it is primarily driven by rhythm. Rhythm drives most of what you hear in popular music, which makes it a great experience at the moment, but it makes rhythm also can make it difficult for a melody to carry any of the weight of the piece. So, and I'm not down on today's music. I love a lot of it, but I do find it its principal motor is rhythm more than the lyric idea or more than a melodic content. That's the great thing about Adele, though, that she brings melody back to the party, you know, a little bit. And I am by nature, and can't change this, a melody writer. I think melodically, I think harmonically. When I think harmonically, I think of atmosphere, particularly in theater, where you say, okay, the characters in this particular kind of jam is in this particular, has this problem. What is the sound of that? What would this emotional sound of that particularly emotional problem be? And I find that. And then melody's pretty much instinctive. You know when it's flat. You know when it's flaccid. You know when it's boring. If it bores you, there's no reason to think it's not going to bore everyone else. That's a long-winded. I hope you're going to edit these answers because I can't seem to. You ask such marvelous questions. I can't seem to shut up. I hope there are four or five things in the show, you know. I'm by nature a melody writer. I pay attention to melody. And there's a mining song, when the miner's on the hillside, you know, trying to find the silver, high, low, high. Listen to the Rain is a song between Josephine and Tianmen, the Chinese man. When you love someone, Jordan sings, Teal. Does a sensational job of singing a song called Unbuttoning the Buttons when Josephine reveals herself to be a woman. Obviously, I'm struggling for an answer. It's a great question. Maybe we should be outside the theater and ask and see the, as they file out, see if they're humming anything other than, you know, I hate that show. I hope they're not humming that.
I'm sure they won't be. We're speaking with Mike Reed. So we're here, I like to call it the Clue Room. Cassie's going to always laugh because I mentioned this that when we have these interviews here at Two River Theater because it reminds me of the game with the Clue Room. And
oh, it
have,
does.
Right?
It does, completely. Oh, I wasn't connecting. Mr. Mustard.
Exactly.
In the library with a wrench.
There you go. Yeah. Exactly. So little Joe Monahan comes back to life, and she takes my place. What do you want to ask her?
Well, that's a fantastic question. I would ask her, why did you do this? What were you thinking? What was your reason for living your life as you did? We all have that. We all can choose, have the right to choose how we live, what we do with our lives. We can't choose when we live them. I would like to ask her why she did what she did.
Cassie Galassetti is who I'm talking about. She's sitting here in the Clue Room at Two River Theater. The show is The Ballad of Little Joe, and not only it's the directorial debut for John Diaz here, and your relationship, then, you've known each other for quite some time.
John and Sarah and I have known each other 25 years. Yeah. We started at the Public Theater. When this was in the piece, I think we met him when this was at the Prince Workshop. John came, and there was something about this story in this piece and a couple of the songs he had heard, and I think we only had about a half an hour of it then, that just hooked him, and it wouldn't let him go. And he said it wasn't too long after that is when he made a promise to Josephine that he wouldn't forget her. So John has been a supporter of Sarah and I's work. We've done two other shows here, a small chamber musical called In This House, and a Christmas show in Wind in the Willows. So this is our third production here at Two River.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar once told me that when I asked him what came first, basketball or his love of music, and he said it was music because in his mother's womb, she was playing jazz music. For you, back in the days in Altoona, sports or music? I think music was probably first for you as well, wasn't it?
They were kind of simultaneous. Yeah, it would have been because my earliest recollection of life, I was 3 years old. We grew up next to my grandmother who had an old hand-carved piano on the sun porch. And I would, when I was 3 or 4 years old, bang on those keys. Now, why I did that, I have no idea. But I can still see myself doing that. Then when I was 6, I asked for piano lessons. And my dad worked for the Pennsylvania Railroad. Mom worked, sold shoes downtown. And once we got a little older, she was at home until we got a little older. But there wasn't classical music or theater in the house or any sort of thing like that. So it came, my earliest memory of music that I heard or that I actually was intent on listening to were hymns in church. I loved those. And it influences the way I write even today. I love those songs of comfort, what I call those great songs of comfort. But at the same time, so I started piano lessons. At the same time, we had a pack of kids in the neighborhood. We had fields to run through and play football 12 months a year and basketball and baseball all year round. Baseball we played in the winter, football we played in the summer. I mean, we didn't pay attention to any season. We played what we felt like. So that was happening at the same time that I was taking piano lessons. But I remember the frustration of being a certain age and my mother saying, no, you'll go out and play football after this hour's worth of practice. And then I decided when I was 13, I was done with that, with music. I wanted to, I was just a kid, a Pennsylvania kid, and I was going to be sports. But you know what happened? I had a mad crush on my piano teacher, Mrs. Carricker, who passed away a couple of years ago. And my dad would say, all right, if you're going to quit taking lessons, then you go in and tell Mrs. Carricker. And I didn't have the heart to say goodbye to her. So it got me through that rough, my little crush on my piano teacher got me through that little time when I thought I'd quit taking lessons.
And obviously before she passed, you let her know that, right?
Oh, absolutely. We had there was a little thing at the Penn State, Altoona branch of the Penn State campus that evening there. And me and a couple of other people got a I did a couple and got some sort of ceremonial thing, and I did a couple of songs, and she was there, and we brought her up on stage. And at the microphone, I revealed that story to her. And then she was just a couple of years after that. She lived to be old and had a good long life. But, yeah, I think even then it was sweet, and she was charmed to hear that.
We move now on to your days at Penn State. Wonderful football career. College Football Hall of Famer. Undefeated seasons at Penn State. What do you remember most? You played under the legendary Joe Paterno. When you think about those days, do they seem a long time ago?
Yeah, they do. But you don't forget somebody like Joe. And Joe, the size of him, or maybe better said, the size of his effect on you. And I must say this, I'm not one to... I think we make, you know, this lionizing of a football coach I'm not against it. I'm just not a big into that. But a guy like Joe, when a young kid, impressionable kid, parents turn their kids over to a guy like Joe. And the kids at that age, what would that be, 17, 18 in the beginning? You kind of think you know what's going on, and you don't realize you don't know anything. And so a man like Joe has a powerful effect. And I think with Joe, it was the first for all of us, Steve Smear, Jack Ham, Franco, Lydell, Denny Oncotts, Ted Kowalik, who went off to a wonderful career with the 49ers. I think it might have been our first encounter with someone who demanded excellence. And there was consequences, you know. And a couple things about Joe. What would anger him at you is not if you were not, it wasn't that you weren't coming up to his level, is that you were not coming up to the level he perceived that you possessed, that you were shortchanging yourself. Don't do that. Don't shortchange yourself. And the other thing was the power of Joe for me. Look, I was even those days a big 230-pound kid. You know, it wasn't physical. I could have reached up and filled my hands with his neck, and that would have been the end of that, right? But I lived in fear of that man. And the fear was that I lived in fear of disappointing him. I just could not bear the thought of disappointing that man. So when you have a guy that inspires that, was he all warm and cuddly and touchy-feely? No, absolutely. He was a fiery Italian, man. And when he got upset, he let you know about it. But he was never, he would get upset and he would let you know, but he would never belittle you. You never felt, even in the under the glare of Joe's wrath, you never felt less than who you were. He was very skilled. He also was extraordinarily skilled about the players he knew he had to lean on to get their best and the ones that he knew he had to kind of encourage them to get their best. And so he had a psychological aspect.
I would describe the 1969 Penn State team in two words, pride and poise. Pride to be the best and realization of what it takes to have poise. Hard work and preparing well.
Very obviously, you know, we could talk endlessly about this guy. He was not a simple man. I don't think great men are simple. I think they're complex on many. You start peeling away layers and you find any manner of greatness and any number of flaws. To think that great men are not flawed is a major mistake. But you don't get over encountering, when you're at an impressionable age, you don't get over encountering a guy like Joe.
He wasn't defensive coordinator at the time, but he was defensive line coach, I believe, when you were there. It was Jerry Sandusky. When the whole scandal broke out, what went through your mind, Mike?
Look, if you made a list of 500 guys that you would think might be involved in this, Jerry would never make that list. And maybe that's the power of something like that, you know? It's right under our noses, and we don't see it. I wish I did. I don't have any insight into this that anybody else has. I do know that there are still, I'm privy to the fact that there are still warring factions. And as long as that continues, it will make healing from this tragedy. You know, I think most stories in sports are melodramatic. I think most sports stories, and I don't care if it's professional sports or, you know, regardless, in my view, they're melodramatic. I think this is an authentic tragedy. The fall of a man who dedicated his life to doing what Joe did makes this tragic. I think anything O.J. Simpson ever did is melodramatic until he decided to do what he did, and it becomes authentic tragedy, you know. But I think most sports stories are melodramatic. I don't know. There's so I don't. I wish I had some sort of insight. I have an opinion about it. But I know as long as these warring factions continue, it will make ultimate healing a lot more difficult. Although I had lunch a couple of months ago with James Franklin in Nashville, and what a marvelous human being that guy is. And with the, isn't it interesting, you know, we have all these troubles and then the team wins. And it begins, you begin to feel a change in the air a little bit. But there's still those people that are at odds over this event. And as long as that continues, the ultimate healing for the university and for that event is going to be very difficult.
You mentioned how the football team is back on top of the college football world. You really were part of that really huge thrust. You mentioned all those names before your teammates.
The whole defense practically is back for 69 with Jack Ham, and you had Denny Oncotts, Mike Reed, Steve Smear. I mean, you can just go down Neil Smith, a great, great team, which proved it throughout the year.
Two undefeated seasons at Penn State. What was that like going through that?
Well, it was, first of all, you have to understand where we were kids. So you don't, a kid doesn't always understand where he is or what he's doing. Look, I gave a commencement address at Penn State a couple of years ago, and I gave two rules of thumb to the boys and the girls. And one of the rule of thumb to the that I said to the young girls, the young women graduating, is rule number one, never ask a boy under the age of 25 what he's thinking. Because he's not. And you'll just confuse him by asking that question. We didn't think, wow, we're really part of something. We were doing, you and I talked a long while ago about the players trying to play at the top level. You know, we were being encouraged to play at the best we could find in ourselves. I think we were finding things in ourselves we didn't know was there because of Joe and the coaches. We had a great, great coaching staff. The first year we were number two in the country, my junior year, my redshirt junior year, was we went down to Miami and we beat Kansas in a very exciting game. The next year it got a little weird, you know, it got strange. This was years and years and years before Penn State went to the Big Ten. So Eastern football had to fight tooth and nail for everything that it got. It really wasn't wasn't even a conference. It was a loosely based collection of schools. There was Penn State, Pitt, Syracuse, Maryland, West Virginia, Boston College, maybe. I'm sure I'm leaving somebody out. And SEC was in business. I think the Nebraska would have been in those days the Big Eight, maybe, then the Big Ten. You had the Big Ten, which was always a dominant conference. I don't know what USC would have been. What would that have been? The Pac-10, maybe? I don't know. I don't know if these conferences even exist anymore. So Eastern football was sort of looked down upon, and it was unusual to see a Penn State team ranked that high. We were thrilled. But the next year, you know, was a very frustrating thing between Ohio State, Oklahoma, I guess it was. No, Texas and Oklahoma and us, or Arkansas and us. And it was the whole Nixon, you know, proclaiming Texas number one, which was probably the right thing to do. But it's still a little bit of a frustration for me. I used that. It's a long-winded story, probably not worth going into. But you had, in those days, you had the four You had maybe five basic bowl games. The Liberty Bowl, which is played early, middle of December. Then you had the four big biggies. The Orange, Cotton, Sugar, and Rose. Well, obviously we weren't going to the Rose Bowl. We were not eligible. So we got an invitation. Ohio State was number one. Texas was two. And as my memory serves me, I think we were three. Arkansas might have been three, and we were four, or we were three, and Arkansas was four, depending on the poll. So we got invited to all the other three bowl games. And Joe said, I think, you know, not Joe's gone, I don't want to, but I think he made an error in leaving it up to the team. So you guys vote, where do you want to go? Well, we had gone to the, well, first of all, Ohio State was the Ohio State team with Rex Kern, and I think Jim Stillwagon was on that team, was as close to a pro team as any college team I've ever seen. They crushed teams week in and week out. We're not going to have a chance at the national championship. Let's go back to the sun, go on a beach, and have a nice time. So we said, okay, we'll go to the Orange Bowl and play in Missouri. Okay, fine, that's what we're going to do. Daggone it, the next week, Ohio State loses to, I think, a 5-4 Michigan team or something like that. Now Texas is number one. They're playing Arkansas. We're number two or three. We're playing Missouri, right? When we should have gone down to play Texas. We should have. It would have been an opportunity to play for the national championship. And we didn't. And Texas wins. Nixon declares them. We win. We ended up number two in the country. And everyone said, well, we were undefeated and we should have. But no, we should have voted to go to play Texas. And the reason the value of that story is that I have told my kids, I have two kids, Maddie's 32 and Katie's 29. As of that experience, their father has told them, there is absolutely no shame in competing and getting your head handed to you. You'll get over that. You'll get over every butt whipping you've ever been through. You get over those. But you never get over not showing up. You never get over not going, showing up for the fight. And in my view, we didn't show up. We should have gone to Texas. And I'm entering old age now. And that still sticks in my craw. I can't get that up or down. I don't think about it all the time. But it was, life only presents you with a few opportunities. They're not going to keep, life is not going to keep doling out opportunities. And when they come along, boy, you've got to really embrace them.
When I see that passion in you, then we understand why you won the Maxwell Award your senior year. You finished fifth in the Heisman Trophy as a defensive lineman, like you were some player. You talk about it as if saying, well, you know, as part of this team, but you were an amazing player, finishing in the Heisman that high. Any thoughts about, you have to realize that career that you had, the Hall of Fame career that you had at Penn State, had to be all worth it.
I have there are chunks of my body still in Beaver Stadium in that field. I just had two knees replaced 3 years ago, and I've got arthritis in my neck and back and a hole in my shoulder. I mean, the game really extracts a price. I'm a foolish man on many fronts. But I'm not one to go back and say I wished I would have, because you look at your life. We all look at our lives, individuals, and their life is composed in a certain way. It almost seems as though it was composed. What I do find, and I don't want to frustrate you or anyone by not regarding anything I might have done with my life, but I just do find that what interests me is what's ahead. I have many, many more days behind me than I have ahead of me. This is, in many ways, that physically can be difficult time, challenging, but in the other ways, it's the richest, deepest, most beautiful time of my life, in a very, very, very quiet way. I could sit here and talk to you about things that are important to me, and I'm sure it would, your eyes would glaze over. It would just be boring for anyone to have to listen to. The big noisy, you know, life gets quieter. I think if God is good or nature is kind and you live, life gets deeper and quieter. And it's doing that for me. There's things that I have. I'm a father, I realize, and every parent will say this. My kids are two of the best human beings I know, Matthew and Caitlin. They're kind, they're gentle, they're funny, they're thoughtful. They have their mother's sensitive, thoughtful side, and they have their old man's sense of humor. And you know that old sod, that old adage, you're only as happy as your saddest child. And I'm the luckiest man in the world in that regard, because both of my kids are living the life they want to live.
What's been the best musical that you've written that they enjoy? And will they be here?
Yeah, they're coming up for the first previews. Maddie and his girlfriend Jamie, although she's girlfriend seems like an old-fashioned term, doesn't it? They're really kind of mates. And Katie and Doug, Katie's husband, Doug, they live in Charlotte. And Susie will be up, my wife, with her brothers, a couple of her brothers, and they'll be here for the first preview. They discovered they have their own lives. They have their own lives. They can't be paying. I never wanted them to overly pay too much attention to anything their dad did or their mother did. Maybe what we tried to teach them when they were young. But my son is in my view, he's just finished up an album. He's a better writer than his old man. He writes about more interesting things. He is a committed artist in that he is finding his voice. His record that he's made, I've heard it before. It's mixed. I think it just takes my breath away to know that your son is doing this kind of work. My daughter is living a life in Charlotte that she loves. She travels. She just got back from China. Is going to head over there again as a buyer. So I love that they're living their own lives. And when they encounter their old man stuff, and it, now they're old enough to say, well, yeah, that's pretty, you know. When they were kids, no. I mean, their dad's music was just old fogey music, you know. But now they'll kind of say, yeah, that's pretty good. But we never let what we do get in the way of how much we mean to one another. So they'll be here. And they won't even, I know Matt and Katie, they don't judge it. They just want to share the experience with the old man.
Kelly on a draw was introduced to Mike Reed, the Bengals' number one draft choice, for a 3-yard loss. Obviously, the Browns would have to find another way to penetrate Paul Brown's defense.
You know, as I was thinking about your career, as we move on to the NFL, where you were an All-Pro with the Cincinnati Bengals, you talked about undersized lineman, who great pass rusher, in the era of the head slap, where you're getting hit. You know, the big story of the NFL right now is, you know, the movie came out a couple years ago, Concussion. So many of the Steeler players that I loved were impacted by that. Do you feel in some way, Mike, that your injuries, you know, you said you left a lot on the field at Beaver Stadium and you had knee problems, but maybe in a sense you were spared the fact that you write these wonderful songs and sing these wonderful songs. Your NFL career was shorter than a lot of others that maybe saved that wonderful brain that's on Mike Reed's head. Have you ever thought about that?
I wonder, it's a curious thing. I wonder at times when I get down, and I do get down over the years, maybe I should have made more out of the football thing was going so well. The Bengals in those days were not anywhere near a Super Bowl team. I'd gone to the Pro Bowl a couple of years. So I often, you know, I've at times when the music, and the music is life, is or the life in the creative world is a very, very circuitous route, ups and downs all the time. And the downs, I think, maybe I should have made more out of the sports thing. Maybe that would have given me something to hang on to when I'm not feeling so hot about things. But I think, and this is only a fairly recent revelation for me. I think when I was young, what I wanted to do was sports. But I remember when I was young that what I wanted to be was a writer. And even if it meant being a bad writer, you know, there's a great, marvelous scene in the movie Dumb and Dumber where Jim Carrey says to the beautiful young woman, "Do I have a chance with you?" And she says, "One in a million." Right? And his response is, "So you're saying I have a chance?" Right? So my feeling about myself is I relate to that because I think, I can imagine someone saying to me, "Yeah, but Reed, you're a lousy writer." But you're saying I'm a writer, okay? Even if you think I'm not a good writer, if you think I'm a writer, that's good. So I think that's what the thing that I hold highest in regard. It's not that I don't hold, when I see a great athlete, the athletic competition that I tend to hold in highest regard tend to be the Olympians. Those are the decathlete to me is an extraordinary achievement. Michael Johnson's 400-meter unbreakable record, you know. Usain Bolt. Can you imagine high jumping? The world high jump record is 8 feet. Can you imagine? Sit under a something 8 feet tall and imagine jumping over it. Unassisted.
No, I don't think about it.
So I don't, those are the athletic achievements that really impress me. The professional sports, I come and go on. I find them as a reasonable entertainment. But I think the great sentence, the great paragraph, the great poem, the great Yeats poem, Elizabeth Bishop, that's that for whatever reason. And I'm not an intellectual. I'm by no means very average intelligence. But that was the thing that, when I discovered the great writers and I started writing myself, is when I first started feeling most like myself. So, I think about maybe I stopped too soon, but, you know, this concussion thing is no, that's not a momentary thing. That's gonna shake out. That's going to change a lot in this game. And there's no getting away from the medical evidence of what's going on with this stuff.
How did that movie impact you, or just any of the things that have been turned, when you hear another player takes his life because of this syndrome, being hit in the head, what goes through Mike Reed's head?
I think of Mike Webster. You remember Mike.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Mike Webster's story, and as it was in that documentary, man, that if you can watch that and not have your heart ache deeply, because right there we're seeing. Now, at the same time, what do you do about a multi-billion-dollar business that I find it frustrating. I guess I find it frustrating when people, for the sake of monetary import, kind of fudge what they know to be the truth. And I think it's every individual's, you know, hey, what would you do if you grew up in the, you know, in the South, you grew up in Texas, you grew up in Pennsylvania from nothing, but had this amazing capacity for this athletic endeavor. And you came from nothing, and suddenly they dump a big pile of money on your table and say, come do this. I think it takes an extraordinary human being to say, no, I'm going to look out for my health. It seems as though they're trying to do something about it, with trying to be tougher on the hits at the head, using the top of the helmet, that kind of thing. But the problem with concussions is it's not the blow to the head, it's the speed. You know, you have these huge guys moving now at, you know, incredible speeds, and it's the brain stopping quickly and bouncing and banging against the inside of the skull that can cause concussions as well as the blow to the head. I don't know. I'm sure, you know, there's a mad scientist somewhere at work at trying to some sort of protective gear. And if he or she comes up with it, I hope they dump a big bag of money in front of them, because this game's not going away. And it's not just football. It's almost any kind of aggressive endeavor we do, you're going to run that risk. What do you do? I made a deal a long time ago that I was not going to die with healthy joints, right? That I was going to live a life that wore them out. I hope that I, right as my joints are done, I hope that's my last day. And I say, okay, come
maybe
out
a
even.
Song. Maybe that'll be your song.
Could be a song.
My joints are done.
My joints are done. Or how about this? All right, how about this for a good old country song? I'm going to write a song called Joint Pain and about people hanging out in a bar nursing their heartaches with beer. Hey, we just come up with a song. I think I'm going to write that. Son of a gun.
Two questions, I promise, before we wrap this up. So let's have a new Mike Reed quartet. But there are stipulations who you can have as the other three members. You're on piano, okay? I want you to pick your singer. Then I want you to pick the sports athlete, maybe pro football, maybe college, maybe coach, that you admire the most to be in your band. Maybe what instrument that person would play. All right? And then the other would be the person who maybe has meant the most to you throughout your life, whether they're gone or still here, to be rounding out your quartet.
All right, what a question. Now, the first is the singer. Mm-hmm. And this has a literal singer, because the others were like metaphorical in a sense.
Real singer.
Boy, I know this is going to sound cheesy for me to say this, or I can't think of a singer. I cannot think of a singer that I love anymore, and very few as much as Bonnie. I had all her records years back in the 70s when I was with the Bengals. She first started, well, that's when I found her records. I can't think of a singer that moves me, that has moved me. There are a couple others to consider. Adele would be one because of this record, Hello, which absolutely floored me. When I first heard Roberta Flack on that album, Quiet Fire was the second. The first album was maybe just titled Her Name. It had The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face on it. That voice, I couldn't get enough of that voice. The very first Your Song, Elton John album. The very first Bruce Hornsby record with The Way It Is on it. These are the greats for me. Great songs, Don Henley, Heart of the Matter. I've been trying to rewrite that for 30 years, probably. But I can't think in the role of the singer in the quartet, I would have to go with Bonnie because no singer has ever done to me emotionally what she has.
So Bonnie Raitt, your singer in the quartet. Now we move on to an athlete. And what instrument would you like to give them?
So I'm going to play piano. Mm-hmm. All right, the next vital instrument would be probably guitar, I would imagine. Or it might be drums, too, because rhythm is so, so, so important. I love groove. I love great grooves. You got to be able to be in the pocket. If you can't play in the pocket, you can't be in the band, all right?
Well, what do you think is easier to learn? Because the last person in your quartet is going to be somebody who means something to you, who maybe isn't a musician, and so you can make that determination.
Boy, isn't this so interesting? What athlete do I most admire? What athlete do I most admire? You know who comes to mind? This is a really obscure answer. This is an obscure answer, and I'm not sure he's the guy I would pick. What would you say if I said the name Al Euter?
Wow, the Olympian.
Yeah. Four-time Olympic gold champ and won three of those gold medals when he was wildly not even close to being a favorite and got in the center ring and psyched everyone out to the point. Al Euter is a consideration. Bob Beamon.
So you watched a lot of Olympic competition then, or you follow the Olympics a lot?
That's the only sporting event I'm absolutely sure to not miss. That and the Tour de France, even on TV. I'll sit there and I'll watch these guys pedal up mountains day after day for the whole 21 days. I never missed the Tour de France.
You are an interesting man. You're not your average, you know, football player, country music thing. There's a lot of depths to Mike Reed. Now, how's about the person that has meant the most to you, and maybe we'll put them on drums.
Well, she wouldn't be on drums, but I'll tell you, she might be guitar. I don't know what instrument she would play. Let me talk about this too. It would be my wife Susan, because Susie and I have been together 42 years. And as I often say, I overheard Susie say on the phone the other day, "I've been with Mike 42 years. It seems like 15 minutes underwater." Right?
Another song.
There's some truth in that, because I'm going to say Susie, for unromantic reasons, our marriage has been like most, difficult at times, impossible at times, filled with joy, filled with trouble, filled with vast gaps of misunderstanding, filled with two people who came together, who seemed to care deeply about one another, but had a difficult time figuring each other out. But we hung in there. She hung in there. She is the best. She's one of the best human beings I know. She's kind. She's thoughtful. Her friends adore her. She's a Pilates instructor, and her clients adore her. She has forced me. You know, you don't always, you can, sometimes you marry or you come together with someone that you love because you love them. And if, at times, for me, Mr. Know-It-All, Mr. Big Shot, you know, back in my 30s, what I realize about Susie, the importance of her, is that against my will and going kicking and screaming, she taught me how to love. She taught me that there were aspects of love in me that I would have never gone to on my own, because they're hard, they're difficult, they're challenging. You know, to love someone, love is sometimes a behavior. It's not just a feeling. My wife has forced me to do my best at trying to grow up, to be a decent man. I haven't always succeeded, and I wish I could redo some things. But she was, when I met her, she is now and will be, though I love and adore my kids, I have dear, marvelous friends that I love. She's the reason for me trying to figure out how to be a better man. So I think really that I would be sheer folly to pick anyone else.
So you kind of took my last question, which would be, what would she have to say to you here with the Ballad of Little Joe when she comes up to Two River Theater to see it that would mean the most to you? So I'll take that a little bit further. You have an opportunity to kind of sneak in a new song to the Ballad of Little Joe, knowing that she's going to be here. What would you talk about? What would that? How could you relate that? Could you do that? Would you be able to do something like that? If I mean, you know, obviously you're not going to, but if you had the opportunity, could you do that?
Well, I'll tell you what. No, probably not, because first of all, Susie's very unromantic when it comes to she and I, right? She's a very practical person. I never have written a song that I didn't play for her or didn't run by her. And even the ones that are, as I get older, are of the more deeply about the honesty of us. One called "Always Gonna Be You," it's on a little record I made that Kenny Chesney cut a couple of years ago. Kenny did a beautiful job.
I could jump on some old highway, run 1,000 miles or more, unlock some hidden mystery behind a distant door. I could sail the seven oceans till I crawl upon some long forgotten shore. But it's always gonna be you, always gonna be you I'm looking for.
another on a little record of mine, and Faith Hill recorded, but it hasn't come out, called When a Man Breaks a Woman's Heart. There's a place in Nashville called the Bluebird Cafe. It's a songwriting haven. You get four songwriters in the circle of the room, and the room only holds about 90 people, and they sit and play their songs. People love it. If you're a song fan, you know, you'll love a night at the Bluebird if you get it, one with really good writers. So she was there one night, and I was doing it with some buddies of mine, and I had written this song called In This Life that Colin Ray recorded, and Bette Midler had a nice record with it. It's very, you know, in this life, you know, of all the things that I, you know, for everything I've, you know, done, what is the most, it is in this life I was loved by you, is the line. So I did a whole introduction of the song mentioning her, you know, about her in my life and all. We get in the car, it's late, we're going home. The Bluebird nights go late. I said, honey, what'd you think of the introduction in this life? And she said something, if this isn't exactly the quote, she said something to the effect, yeah, what a load. Right? And I said, why? She said, oh, come on. That was all about you. That wasn't about me. And she was 100% right.
For all I'd been blessed with in this life, there was an emptiness in me. I was imprisoned by the power of gold. With one honest touch, you set me free. Let the world stop turning, let the sun stop burning, let them tell me love's not worth going through. If it all falls apart, I will know deep in my heart the only dream this life, I was loved by you.
So that's Susie. So I wouldn't, if it was a song, the song, per your question, if it was a song in the show that was directed at her that didn't fit the show, she would say to me, why'd you put that, that song doesn't belong in that show. She would figure it out right away. Her thing would be, wow. Yeah, I think you really nailed it. That show really works. That's all she would have to, you know. She's very, look, she knows when it comes to me, she knows where the bodies are buried. She knows the skeletons in the closet. I'm not going to romance her now other than to respect and admire her for the person she is. She's not buying the candy and flowers anymore. It better be a little more real than that.
Of everything that you've done, the 1991 hit, Walk on Faith, I started humming it over the last few days, which is a great thing, obviously, you know, if I'm humming it. Do you sing it in the shower anymore?
Oh, yeah. I sing that song quite a lot. And when I play at the Bird or I'll do fundraisers or... You know why I sing that song? Because Alan Chamberlain and I wrote that song, and we wrote it. It was Alan's idea, and we just tried to... You know, you and I have talked about the theme of trying to do something to its fullest, whether you're an athlete. Al and I were just trying to write that idea as honestly and truly as we could. And the other day, there was a thing at the CMA called Poets and Prophets, where they induct a songwriter into that wing of this Country Music Hall of Fame, and they did it, and they do a kind of a This Is Your Life thing. And so about six weeks ago, they was mine deal, and it was lovely. And they have you sing, and I sang that song. I sang Walk on Faith. And Alan was there, and I said, you know, we both marvel over the... At the time, we were just trying to write a song that was as accurate to the title as we could. And we marvel that all these years later, how that song now is more applicable to life now than it was when we wrote it. By changing one word, all you have to do is change one word. The opening line is... of the original is, we have come to the place in our love where faith must be stronger than fear. And if you just change love to life, you find that it opens it up to anyone who happens to encounter the song. We have come to the place in our lives where faith must be stronger than fear. And we're living in that time. We marvel that, and that's why I try to sing that song as much as I can.
Well, we're certainly, we have the faith that, when we come to Two River Theater, there's always excellent shows, and now we have The Ballad of Little Joe. The amazing Mike Reed, what a pleasure it has been to sit down with you.
You ask, I'm so sorry to be so long-winded, but you ask such wonderful, and I don't get interviewed, you know, the way I used to, so you ask such marvelous questions, and I hope you have a good editing thumb there. You can cut this up and use it as you see fit.
We're just going to let it roll, Mike.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you.
The Ballad of Little Joe runs from June 3rd to June 26th at Two River Theater in Red Bank. The music provided by Mike Reed. Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can check out all the podcasts by going to WBGO.org/Sports Jam or find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on iTunes. Until our next Sports Jam session, I'll see you at the game.